I'm Dr. Amalia Gonyas-Malka. Welcome to Womanity, Woman in Unity, the show that celebrates women's milestone achievements in their struggle for liberation, self-emancipation, human rights, democracy, and much more. Joining us today is Dr. Bridget O'Neill Kruger, who is a clinical psychologist as well as a holistic and earth medicine practitioner who applies an integrative and holistic approach to treating patients.
Thank you, Amalia. It's a pleasure to be talking to both you and your listeners.
Dr. O'Neill Kruger, you know, we're at the beginning of the year, well, a month in. And one of the things that is a trend is that people will list resolutions about what they want to change, what they want to do. Unfortunately, the sad reality is that only 8% of people end up achieving their New Year's resolutions. And that's according to a study by the University of Scranton. Can you share with us some of the reasons that so few people are able to meet and fulfill those New Year's resolutions?
Yeah, I think there are several reasons, Amalia, that springs to mind. Firstly, I think it's often a case of biting off more than one can chew, meaning that people want to do everything all at once. They want to lose weight, stop smoking, start exercising. They want to fix relationships, learn new skills. And it's actually just too much. We are setting ourselves up for failure. And I think we've got to understand that less is more. And at the same time, I think people often are also very perfectionistic in their approach, wanting their efforts to be 100% in place 100% of the time. They kind of don't leave room for the ebb and flow of life and circumstances. So I think similar to the biting off more than one can chew, it's simply just not sustainable. If I think it's more a case of if you do want to reach goals like New Year's resolutions, you've got to be flexible in your approach. And maybe even having said that, perhaps the issue is also in the question, so to speak. The fact that very often I think we only end up thinking of the kind of life that we want for ourselves or what we want to create for ourselves once a year when kind of the New Year celebrations roll past. But I think surely we've got to approach that in a more sustainable way of really trying to incorporate the changes we seek throughout the year in smaller batches and smaller bites, which I think would also take a lot of the pressure off this idea of New Year's resolutions, which then usually doesn't, I think, even as we're sitting into the month of January and it's almost at its end, I think for many people, those New Year's resolutions may have already gone out the window.
Such a strong point that you mentioned there at the end, that it shouldn't really be thinking about changes just once a year. With that aspect in mind, what kind of advice can you give to people to help sustain resolutions and maybe revisit them periodically?
Look, I think one of the things that comes up for me definitely there is, two things maybe, Amalia. The one is that I think if we kind of take smaller bites and we take, I think also one thing at a time, I find that it's one thing to have a list of things that you want to change. But when it comes to implementation, I think you've got to take it one at a time. Take one change or one habit that you want to incorporate, get into a rhythm with it, get it to feel a little bit more of a organic, natural habit rather than something that you're having to work at. And once you feel a little bit more confident with that, layer in a next one. So you kind of almost scaffold in layers. If you, for example, wanted to get healthier and lose weight, maybe for the first 3 weeks, just start by incorporating water. More water into your regime. And then after 3 weeks, maybe add something like, okay, now I'm going to go for a brisk walk every day. And then 3 weeks later, add in something else. And I think what's going to happen is that after 365 days, you're going to have more of a sustainable practice of many different things that you would have incorporated rather than, as we've just said, this thing of everything all at once, and then it flies out the window in 2 weeks' time. And I think the other thing that came up as you asked this is maybe I'm kind of recording, I think, your progress, your goals, really putting the intention down on paper, I think is very helpful oftentimes. so that you can also for yourself track where you've come from, what you're struggling with, where your successes are.
It sounds like it's a system that could work for anything by establishing a habit, integrating it into what you're already doing, because as you mentioned, we often try and bite off more than we can chew, and then tracking progress so that you can see how you are advancing and achieving your goals. Thank you.
Absolutely.
I find psychology an incredible field, and especially about human behavior and the ability of changing the way we do certain things or our approach to get different outcomes. And it's clearly been a very core subject for you amongst a variety of your other interests. I mean, your undergrad and your honors degree was attained in psychology from University of South Africa. You did your master's in clinical psychology, and you received your doctorate in psychology from the University of the Free State. So, thinking about the specialization, what were some of the reasons that you decided to become a psychologist?
Sure. Yes. That's actually quite a question that I often get asked. I think many psychologists do, and I'm actually not sure whether I yet have a very succinct answer to it. And I think it's also actually quite a long story that has a lot of context to be understood to it. I've always been someone with a lot of different interests and passions, and I'm a bit of what I think you can call a Renaissance soul, which is a term I relate to quite a bit. I don't know if you're familiar with it. A Renaissance soul, they kind of describe as somebody with many different passions that and interests then that are kind of equal in weight. So it's really difficult for them to necessarily make a distinction between which of those passions or interests are then their kind of main interest and a job in a way, if you will, and which are the hobbies. So I think with that said, for a long while, it was actually quite difficult for me to clarify exactly which road I should take. I also grew up in a time where the message I received from society and my parents around me was that there were certain endeavors that would be considered jobs, and that you do for an income, and which is superior to any of the other things that you may be considered hobbies. So I think that really did my head in as a youngster. Originally, I actually pursued traditional Western medicine, envisioning that I would go into surgery. But then life took me on a journey, as it tends to do. And in the end, I did end up completing my qualifications in psychology, amongst other things, as you say. But psychology was always part of the mixed bag of interest. And I think the contributing factors piquing my interest was definitely something about understanding the mind and why people do what they do. Perhaps also the experiences I had in my own family system and growing up played their role. But I am also quite an introvert, so I am actually quite used to spending a lot of time in introspection and within the internal spaces of my own body and mind and emotions. So I think it was also, I suppose, a bit of a natural step for me to make a career out of it, of how to also not only explore other people's internal worlds, but at the same time teach them how to do that for themselves as well, which is in a big way, I think, what psychology is about for me as well.
Some massive tool to be able to achieve the results that you want as an individual and have an impact on the world. You mentioned in terms of the background that you grew up in, and I think for a lot of people that parents, society may be a little traditionally minded, and that has a strong influence on the choices that young women make for their careers. But yet at the same time, that may not be where they want to go for themselves. And if I think about how the world has changed dramatically, if we think about the opportunities in the technology space, these roles just simply didn't exist a couple of years ago. What would be your advice to them about pursuing their fields, their interests?
Yeah, that is you. You're absolutely spot on, Malaya. And I think it is a tricky question as well, because as you rightfully say, it is that balance between the input from families, and especially if one comes from a more traditional family background, where of course there's things like respecting elders and taking the input and also the wishes of one's family. It can really be difficult, I think, to beat the sound of your own drum. And to really follow your own gut and your own kind of vision and passions. But I think nonetheless, that is perhaps part of my response, is that I think it is about really trying to stay into connection and in tune with your own drives and your own intuitions and what really kind of gets your passion going. Because I think that's, for me, one of the many secrets of how I've come to be where I'm at, is that everything I've done has very much been driven by my passion, and everything that I do, I have a passion for. And I think that also makes it easier when you have to pursue big dreams, that brings with it their own sacrifices and their own challenges. And you then have to draw on something somewhere within yourself to kind of make it through the tougher times. And knowing that it's a passion and something that you feel strongly about really helps. But I think there's also, for me, something as we talk about this that comes up around knowing that you've got enough time. I think so often I find people driven by this kind of concept of time breathing down their neck, and wanting again to figure it all out, right from the start and get it all right. Know also that you can change direction, that whether you take a path that you've taken because of the expectations or the demands of those around you, or whether you yourself thought that that was a path for you, but then somewhere along the line, maybe figure out that it's not. Don't waste time beating up on yourself or feeding into, I think, feelings of, resentments or what we may even feel towards other people. I think it is about knowing you can always change the course. As you're learning about yourself, just redirect. And I think even in my own journey, I think what has been amazing is I've walked many different paths of my passions again. And in the end, some of them may have in the beginning seemed quite worlds apart, and like they could never meet up in a way. But somehow what has been really beautiful in my journey is that over the years, I've now come to a point where I've even been able to integrate all of these passions into different kind of offerings that maybe 10, 20 years ago I wouldn't have envisioned that this was that this, pardon me, would be the way that it would go. So you just don't know, but don't get despondent. Know you can course redirect if you need to, and try and follow your own passions.
That's important advice. And I really think that you are someone who has gone to the beat of your own drum, integrating, incorporating the different elements that you've been exposed to, the different learnings. I'd like you to tap in a little bit on that. My understanding is you've got an integrative philosophy on treatments and how you customize them according to what an individual needs. Can you give us a couple of examples of the types of approaches that you apply?
Yes, you're quite right, Amala. My approach is very much integrative. It kind of makes space for all parts of the person, not just their mind or their emotions or behavior, which I think traditionally in psychology, those have been kind of the areas that we would focus on from a psychological point of view, especially a traditional Western psychology point of view. And I think with that said, I think in this traditional psychology view, we've placed so much focus on the brain and on the mind. And we've actually ended up forgetting about the body and the spirit. In my approach, I actually end up putting quite a strong focus on the interconnectedness then of the mind, the body, and the spirit as it relates to our health and well-being, which is very much also been kind of reflected and the product of, I suppose, my integrated background of study as well. I basically then, in this integrated approach, I draw on many different perspectives, psychological perspectives, maybe firstly being things like attachment theory, emotionally focused therapy that also flows from it, attachment theory, as well as ecosystemic theories, mindfulness and contemplative practices, as well as then eco-psychology, kind of looking at also where we as humans fit into the greater ecological system that is the planet and other species as well. And my offerings then also with that weave in a lot of more kind of alternative and even Eastern approaches, that is not so much coming from traditional psychology per se. So things like emotional freedom technique or tapping, as many people know it, also Chinese meridian therapy, which I studied, and eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. Sound and energy work, which is also a large part of what I do, and then things like nature and animals, weaving that in, breath work, the list really goes on. So I think when people then arrive at my practice and in my rooms, I'm kind of always having this mixed bag of tools and backgrounds and informations and schools of thought in that bag. And we kind of end up drawing from that bag based on what the person is coming in with. So I don't particularly have any preconceived framework with which I necessarily approach every, well, maybe I do, if we think of my rewilded being framework as well. But on the whole, it is firstly letting the person's unique situation speak for itself. And it's kind of my job to, I think, align and feel very intuitively and strongly into where they are at and meeting them where they are at in order to also then get them where they want to be.
It sounds like such an open approach.
I like how you say open. That's kind of a nice image for it, an open approach. I think it is open. It's open because I think it's also one of the things I actually have written in my psychotherapy contract that people sign when they start working with me is that this work is a joint process for me. I think for me, it's never something that I do to a person. I also don't necessarily hold myself in that image of a healer, but rather maybe somebody who facilitates healing and who holds a space in which a person can kind of do the kind of work that they need to in order to get them to a more whole place. So it's always for me a joint process. So yeah, I like your image of it being an open approach.
How receptive do you feel that women are to an integrative therapeutic approach?
I love that question. Yeah, I actually find, Amalaya, that a lot of people, and then especially women, actually end up seeking me out because of my holistic integrative approach and also my particular background and offerings. I think there's something that seems to resonate for women about returning to our natural, raw, and complete state. I think there's also something in us that wants to be seen and felt as our whole selves. I think our psyches and spirits are tired of being separated and dissected out, which unfortunately is sometimes a very Western approach to things as well. We're tired of having parts of ourselves cut off or even shamed as being too much or not enough or shameful in a way. So I've actually definitely observed a stirring and a awakening happening in people's bodies and psyches, and definitely in the bodies and psyches of women. And I think that's exactly where my approach actually then ends up benefiting people as it meets them in that, in whatever is stirring and whatever needs to be validated and made space for in themselves. That's where we meet them. And I think essentially women are increasingly catching on to the fact that we need to make space for our whole selves if we are going to actually heal and grow effectively.
Such a challenge. And I think a lot of this is the demands of society because we are multidimensional. But if you think about it, everybody likes to box somebody into what they know and have their definition. And that's kind of their outward view of whether it's friends, whether it's work colleagues. It's sort of like how they fit into their respective boxes. But the truth is, no one wholly fits into a box because we have these different components and aspects.
Absolutely. Yeah, I love that. I think we are forever boxing one another and also trying to box ourselves. And then if we don't fit into whatever box we ourselves expect us to fit into, or the people around us or society, then I think absolutely that is where it can damage, and it can stir a lot of breaking offs almost of parts of ourselves and a lot of those kind of shame feelings. So it is quite bizarre. I think we also live in a world where increasingly these days, I think there's so many labels and boxes and things going around, and I think I sometimes, even in working with people, have this urge to almost just throw out all the labels, all the boxes, and just, I think that is my nature, is that I don't often care too much for the particular labels or boxes, even though I think diagnostically, even in my field of work, we do need the labels, of course, to often guide treatment focus. But at the same time, every person is just so unique that you've got to understand what is stirring in their pot.
Yeah, and we can have labels. Sometimes it's easier a little bit than other times, and sometimes we can have multiple ones happening at the same. One thing that I'd really like you to tell us a little bit more about, and you mentioned it briefly, is your rewilded being.
So I think my rewilded being model is a model of well-being, first of all. And I think it is basically it's the product of my years of study in these various fields that I've kind of tapped into, combined then with my experience working with people in clinical practice, and also my experience as a human in life and walking my own journey of healing and growth and integration. So through it all, I think I've kind of increasingly just been aware that, or concluded, shall I say, that the core issue, I think, and challenge to our well-being seems to be, for me at least, then disconnection. We are disconnected from ourselves. We are disconnected from one another, from other non-human animals, from nature, excuse me, and the planet. And I think my belief then, which underpins this whole model of well-being that I work with, is that if one can restore that connection, you can then start to actually rewild yourself back into connection and also back into well-being for yourself, for other people, for other species, and also the planet. And that is what will for me bring the healing. So therefore, my work with people is always infused with this idea, which is then embodied by the rewilded being model, that helps them to develop the behaviors, the practices, the mindsets, and the heart spaces that generate that connection, that relationality, ecological humility and respect, personal awareness, accountability, as well as then compassion and kindness. So I think that's always the lens through which, as I'm working and as I view the little unique pots that people kind of bring to the table, I'm always kind of looking at the factors that kind of come together in that connection concept for me. I'm basically looking at how do we make the connection on whatever level that connection may have been lost.
Is there a quick tip that you could share with our listeners as a strategy of developing connections, whether it's with self, others, or as you say, nature and non-humans?
Yeah, I think, Amalia, a starting point always for me with that is actually going back. Firstly, I think it does start any form of connection on how do I want to put it? It's almost like any connection that needs to be restored on the levels outside of ourselves. So with other people, with other species, the planet, I think all of that is for me subject to firstly the connection with ourselves. Because I think if we can't make a connection with my own body, my own emotions, my own sense of self, I'm really then not going to make a connection with the next person or the greater planet or nature as a whole. So I think the first step for me would always be about connecting to yourself. And I think one of the starter points, I suppose, that many therapists I'm sure will agree with me, is kind of just starting with something as basic as your body and your breath, and just really starting with practicing things like meditation, for example. And meditation always sounds so grand and fancy and complicated, but it's really just a simple mindfulness of breath, even can be so powerful, where closing one's eyes for a moment, sensing into your breath and just putting that attention on your breathing and noticing how the breath flows in and out of the body, noticing perhaps how this temperature changes, looking at what happens to your body as you're inhaling and exhaling. And as you're doing that, what's going to happen is that your mind is going to want to wander somewhere else. It's going to want to show you something else, tell you about something else, think about your day ahead or things that have happened. And that's okay. When that happens, we meet our mind with kindness and compassion, and but we still stay very neutral, so we don't get pulled into that. So as you're focusing on your breath, just taking and the mind then wants to take you elsewhere, just gently acknowledging where your mind wants to take you, but then also very gently but firmly guiding that attention back to the breath. And that is in itself a basic mindfulness of breathing practice, where it is about our mind's going to want to take us elsewhere, but the practice of that mind muscle that we're working on is about gently redirecting the attention and just staying with our breath. And as we're also staying with the breath, we can do the same thing about tuning into the rest of our body. And I think that is a it's a very simple but incredibly powerful techniques for a variety of uses, actually. But as far as connection is concerned, I think it really starts to build that foundation of connecting back to self. And from there, one can then definitely grow that practice out and expand it to also include different layers of connecting with yourself and then taking it out, as we say, to other people, relationships, the planets, and so forth.
Very powerful, practical tip. Thanks for sharing that with us. You're listening to Womanity, Woman in Unity, and today we're talking to Dr. Bridget O'Neill Kruger, who is a clinical psychologist and earth medicine practitioner based in Cape Town, South Africa. Dr. O'Neill Kruger, you've shared with us aspects of psychology, particularly from a self point of view, and the importance of connection. Moving slightly away from that, but still equally important in the space, is that one of the challenges that we have from a South African point of view is gender-based violence for women. And psychological and physical safety are certainly important factors in a person's well-being. Yet when we look at these heinous acts and the crime stats, for instance, in quarter two of 23, 2024, it indicated that South Africa recorded 10,516 rapes, 14,401 assaults against victims. These figures are appalling, but the reality is they really represent what many women in this country experience. At the same time, it's something that they may not necessarily be able to get away from the environment that is causing this harm. Are there any effective strategies or interventions that you find helpful to working with survivors of gender-based violence?
Yeah, I mean, that is such a big kind of pain point, I think, in our world, in South Africa, definitely, but even perhaps the greater planet and globally and internationally. I also think that's a very big question and a topic that perhaps is too complicated for me to give a short and simple answer to. But what I will say is that in my experience, there's usually significant layers of trauma with survivors of gender-based violence, and layers that relate to their own view of self, their attachment history, their ecosystemic and environmental influences, also gender stereotypes and beliefs. The list really goes on. So there's a lot that needs to be untangled. So I would definitely firstly say, maybe not a big surprise coming from a psychologist, but I would say that psychotherapy or counseling in general is highly recommended for survivors. And I know, of course, our survivors come from different socioeconomic status backgrounds and situations. So access to such mental health services are sometimes quite scarce. But I think it doesn't necessarily for me matter too much whether you are sitting, for example, with the highest specialized psychologist or psychiatrist, or whether you are able to access a well-trained and caring community counselor of sort. At the end of the day, it is about being able to sit with someone who can help you untangle all those layers. But then also, I think, secondly, apart from talk therapy only, I also find body-based somatic work to be very, very beneficial. So again, things like the EMDR, that eye movement desensitization and reprocessing that I think I mentioned earlier, also trauma release exercises, TRE, even inner dance that I work with there, which is the energy and sound modality, can be very helpful. Then also creative release work, which sometimes is a lot more easy to access, I suppose, and not as costly as some of these other measures. So things like dance or art therapy can really be powerful, because I think it for me, the thinking comes from the reminder that when we are affected by trauma, it actually does affect our minds, of course, but also our bodies and spirits again. So it's definitely something that I like for people to, and would recommend for them to try and untangle through an integration of different strategies and modalities to really speak to all the parts of themselves that have been impacted by that trauma.
One of the things that I've definitely taken away from today's conversation is that it's not just about focusing on one, whether it's mind or body. It's about this integrative approach and being able to tap into different elements within ourselves, whether it's a creative expression through artwork or sound and dance, and to recognize these parts of us to optimize healing and growth.
Absolutely, absolutely. And yeah, as much as I say, it's also about having a safe space to help somebody, or to have somebody rather help you untangle some of those layers. At the same time, I think that's always for me the thing, Malaya, you suddenly, as we talk about this, remind me of the thing about the inner healing intelligence. I don't know if you're familiar with the term, but the inner healing intelligence essentially is that thing that exists in all of us, and it also exists in nature. And of course, we are also nature, hence why we have that. So inner healing intelligence is that thing that, if you think of a tree as well, and maybe the a tree that has like a little acorn that would drop from it, that little acorn that falls, if and I may be wrong, except my apologies to any of the kind of real nature experts and scientists around us if I get it wrong, but the gist of it, I'm sure you will get what I'm talking about. But if we have a little acorn, and that little acorn needs to grow into a big tree, if we put that acorn into a particular environment where it is getting the right soil and climate and water, what's going to happen is that little acorn is going to grow into a big tree, and it doesn't need anything from the environment, or let me correct that. It doesn't need to be told, shall I put it that way, how to grow into a tree. It doesn't have to get directions from anywhere. If it's put into the right environment, it will grow into a big strapping tree. And I think that essentially is what we're talking about and are referring to as the inner healing intelligence. And we see the same thing happening in our bodies, is that if I get a scratch on my hand, if I disinfect that and I maybe put a nice little band-aid on it and I keep it clean, so I'm basically creating a certain environment, then my body instinctively knows what to do to heal that wound. And I think that's the same for us as humans, is that yes, there's all these outside things that we can use and therapies and other people, but there's almost also so much that I think nature, God, the universe, whatever one's framework is that makes sense to you, we have been given that. And we've got also this inner healing intelligence inside ourselves that if we can put ourselves in the right environments through certain practices and kind of awareness of our daily kind of surroundings, what will happen is that we can then create an environment again for healing, even just by ourselves. So again, going back to something as simple, powerful as creative expression of dance, of art forms, that can be so healing. And I think it is, yeah, you kind of make me think of that in a way of also just what we carry with ourselves to also aid ourselves and not having to always feel also a little bit like, my language is now going around that. Just feeling like we've got to be dependent. That's maybe the word I'm looking for. We don't always have to be dependent on anything or anyone else for our growth and healing either. But yeah.
Thanks for explaining the concept of inner healing intelligence. And it also, if I can put it, some aspects of it into one word, it's about trusting ourselves in a way.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Look, you're touching there on something, I think, Amalaya, that can probably have me, yeah, talking even more for hours. But I think trust is everything. And specifically, as you say, the trust in oneself. Because I find so often people will come into my office and sit on my couch and we'll have conversations around them feeling like they can't trust other people and they can't trust the environment around them. And sometimes rightfully so, because they may have had atrocious things happening to them in certain environments and at the hand of other people. But then at the same time, I think it always, I try and take it back to that place of, can we trust ourselves though? Can we tap into our own healthy control and responsibility and our own capability as far as our control is concerned, to know that we always have that power. And if we can trust ourselves, it wouldn't matter what necessarily fully is happening in the environment, because we can't, of course, control the environment and other people. Stuff will happen. We will be exposed to things, we will be victim to things. But knowing as well that we can trust ourselves and knowing that we've got our own backs, I think that is gold. Being able to tap into that really is powerful.
I wish that we had more time, but we have literally run down the clock. So,
Oh my goodness.
as we close out today's show, to share a few words of inspiration or wisdom to girls and women who are listening to us.
Sure, Amalia, I can't believe our time's out. I'm with you. There was so much more that I think we could have spoken about. But I think in closing, yes, I think the thing definitely that screams at me as we're sitting and closing this conversation is that it's about learning to listen to your own intuition. I think if that's one thing that I would have been able to, or would have wanted rather, to give to other women, and definitely even to a younger version of myself, is to have learned sooner in my life to really trust that little voice, those nudges that show you the way, really trying to learn to trust it and follow it. Because I think if you let it, it really will be your most valuable companion. Because again, it's like the inner healing intelligence. We've got that guidance inside ourselves. I think everything I do is very spiritually focused in my own life as well, and I operate quite strongly tapped into that energy, and that something that is bigger than all of us. And I think for me, that our intuition is linked to that. That is the little gift that we've been given, the little GPS, if you will, as we embarked on this human experience. That's the little internal GPS that keeps us on track. So definitely, I think it is about learning to listen to that intuition. And also, maybe lastly, don't be afraid of your own voice. I think it is more powerful and more beautiful than you may know. And it holds its own unique gifts, and the world needs that. We don't have to be carbon copies of each other. You can just bring you, and what you bring is enough, and what you bring is exactly what the world needs.
Fantastic words. Thank you very much for today's conversation. I really appreciate it. And as always, I get to learn so much.
Thank you so much, Amalaya. It's been lovely. I'm with you. I just regret that we didn't have more time. But thank you very much.
You have been listening to Womanity, Woman in Unity, and we have been talking to Dr. Bridget O'Neill Kruger, who is a clinical psychologist and earth medicine practitioner based in Cape Town, South Africa.